Welcome to the New Statesman in Conversation panel discussion in partnership with UK in a Changing Europe. I'm Zoe Grunewald and I am policy and politics correspondent for the New Statesman, and it is my pleasure to introduce our speakers for the event. Wes Streeting is the Shadow Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, as I'm sure you'll all know. He leads on Labour's mission to build an NHS fit for the future, and he will be discussing that with Anand Menon, Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London. There'll be an opportunity for you guys to ask questions at the end of the session, but first, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Wes and Anand.
Thanks ever so much, Zoe. And just to say, we've done this with the New Statesman, I think, about 5-6 years in a row, and they're a treat to work with, and we look forward to it every year, so thank you all. I'm not going to introduce Wes, because you know who he is. I've attracted a very big audience for you. Are you impressed? This is my...
There are more people at this one fringe event than at the entire Conservative Party conference. Very good.
So, speaking of which, let's start with that. What did you make of the Tory conference last week?
Thanks very much. What did I make of the Conservative Party conference last week?
Starter for 10.
I sort of got the impression that they looked at the Labour Party sort of circa 2015 to 2019 and thought, you know what, we really need a piece of that action. And just as we have, turned our party inside out, anchored it back in the priorities and interests of the British people, moved the Labour Party back to where it always belongs, which is in the political mainstream, the centre-left, they have decided to abandon the political position that saw them win successive general elections since 2010 to different degrees under very different leaders, and just abandoned the sort of centre ground of the centre-right altogether and drift off. And so, whereas we have kicked extremists out of the Labour Party, Rishi Sunak has sought to pander to them. And in fact, they are not only being pandered to, they are being cheered from the rafters at the Conservative Party conference. And even notionally sensible Conservatives who would probably describe themselves as being in the mainstream chose to use the conference platform to peddle conspiracy theories and indulge the crackpots and the cranks in a way that I find pretty unedifying and disturbing, actually, to hear from ministers of the Crown and people who sit around the cabinet table. And that is just one of many, many reasons why it is in this country's national self-interest to eject the Conservative Party from office at the next general election. Apart from that, I thought it was great.
I sense you've been asked that question before, but
I'm trying to find different ways to answer some of the questions for the people in the audience who've been stalking me around every fringe.
In a recent interview, you said successful leaders meet the party where it is, then take it on a journey to where the country is. Is that how you see what Keir Starmer has done to the Labour Party?
Yeah, he's had, I think, three distinct phases to his leadership, and the strategy he set out when he won the leadership of the Labour Party. The first was to change the Labour Party, to show the country that we understood why we were rejected in 2019 with the worst result since 1935, to change the Labour Party so it could once again earn a hearing with the public. The second phase was to demonstrate why the Conservative Party were unfit to govern. And, this is not a criticism of Keir, but actually the Conservative Party's done an awful lot of that for us, so we appreciate their efforts. And the third and most important phase is the one we are in now, and why this conference here in Liverpool is so important. Answering the question, well, if not the Conservatives, why Labour? And I think we have earned that hearing. People can see the change in the Labour Party. And now we have an opportunity to not just diagnose what's wrong with the country, but set out our prescription. And in the case of the NHS, I was just doorstopped on the way in by Sarah Montague and the BBC to sort of answer that question, why Labour? And I sort of basically just said, well, I'll just take the NHS as just one example. You know, in the last couple of days, we've announced a plan to deliver 2 million more appointments to get the NHS waiting list down and put £1.1 billion into the pockets of NHS staff who, like other people, are struggling in the cost of living crisis. We've announced a rescue plan for NHS dentistry, 700,000 more appointments a year. And we've announced a plan to double the number of diagnostic scanners, MRI scanners, CT scanners with our Fit for the Future fund. Now, taken together with the biggest expansion of NHS staff in history, dedicated mental health support in every primary and secondary school in the country, community mental health hubs in every community. If we just did one of those things I've just mentioned, which are all Labour Party policy, fully costed, fully funded, if we did just one of those things, we'd make a really significant difference to the lives of people in this country. Taken together, they form the foundation of the basis of a plan to get the NHS back on its feet and fit for the future. And that's just in the NHS. Right across the board, you heard, you know, Rachel's extraordinary speech today, rousing speech about how we get growth back into our economy, improve people's living standards, create jobs, and focus our country on tackling the big challenges of the future, like net zero. And so obviously tomorrow we've got the most important speech of all, which is Keir's speech setting out his stall as to why he should be Prime Minister after the next general election, the vision for the country that he has and the plan and the team he has built to deliver it. So, I hope that as we come out of this conference, our candidates will have lots of retail policies to put on leaflets and to have those persuasion conversations. Even more than that, I hope that voters begin to build a sense of hope, actually, and possibility that politics can be part of the solution rather than constantly being part of the problem. Because if there's one thing I've really noticed in recent weeks on the doorsteps in Tamworth and Mid-Beds and Rutherglen, where we did very well, Selby and Ainsty, where I suddenly felt very old seeing a former parliamentary researcher of mine being elected to Parliament. I thought that's not supposed to happen for at least another 20 years, but there we go. There is a real sense amongst lots of people of the hope having been beaten out of them. And there are lots of people in our country who say, I've had enough of those Tories. I'm just not sure if anyone can solve these problems. It's just too bad. It's too broken. It's too difficult. So we've got to give people their hope back and give them reassurance that Labour is capable of giving Britain its future back.
Okay, I'm going to come on to the health service and the Labour Party. I want to talk about you a little bit. I believe you've recently written a book, One Boy, Two Bills and a Fryer, which I would have brought to get you to sign, but I forgot it. But
well, it's funny you should mention that, because downstairs at the bookshop...
I'm not buying it again.
It is available, and you can all buy a copy, and I'll be very happy to sign it. It was a Sunday Times best-selling book. I don't think you mentioned that. Don't worry.
You've answered this before as well, haven't you? Keep going. So the really interesting thing about the book is you talk a lot about yourself and your family and your background, and you talk a lot about your working class background. And one of the things you say is there aren't enough people who grew up on council estates in Parliament. Why does that matter?
Because I think one of the reasons why the social contract in this country has been shattered and why we have a cost of living crisis where people on lower middle incomes have been most sharply affected, it's not because the people who sat around the cabinet table are evil or bad people with awful intentions. It's because too many of them who are making decisions that affect the lives of millions of people in our country just don't know what life is like for normal people, let alone people at the sharp end. It's a fundamental problem with the Conservative cabinet. And, I'm not saying that the change in faces is everything. It's the policies that ultimately matter and not the personalities. But one of the reasons why we have got a candidate for Prime Minister who talks about shattering the class ceiling in our country is because Keir himself comes from a humble background. His, mum was a nurse, his dad was a tool maker, and Keir has spoken himself about life at the sharp end. Angela Rayner is in the incredible position of having gone from being a care worker to potentially being my best ally in government, helping to build a national care service as hopefully the future Secretary of State for local government, which is a crucial partner in social care, and building the homes people need, having grown up on a council house. And my God, I thought I had it tough growing up. Angela makes me look posh in terms of what she has been through and the hardship she's overcome. How incredible that someone who's come from, the School of Hard Knocks and the University of Life might be our country's Deputy Prime Minister. The reason why I'm excited about the prospect of Bridget Phillipson being the Secretary of State for Education is because, like me, she grew up in poverty and we would not be where we are without the transformational power of a state education. So we lived it, we get it. And I think that perspective, that lived experience, makes such a difference, especially at a time when, as Rachel said, times are tough and there are hard choices to be made. So it's even more important that those choices are Labour policies and choices that serve the interests of the many in our country, not simply a privileged few. So there's one thing that has really made my blood boil in terms of this government's choices and their reaction to Labour policies. You know, when Rachel talks about taxing non-doms or closing the tax loopholes enjoyed by private equity fund managers or removing the tax breaks that are enjoyed by private schools, there's no shortage of Conservative MPs and cabinet ministers going out to say, well, that can't possibly be done. It's too difficult. It's all, just think of the non-doms. What if they flee? Well, then, you know, I mean, we know one prominent non-dom, who lives not too far from the Chancellor. And last time I checked, she's chosen to pay her taxes here and she's not fled the country. So I think we can assume that we'll be okay on that front. So always reasons not to go after people with the broadest shoulders, to ask them to make a contribution to help our country out of hard times. But my goodness, they don't blink when it comes to increasing taxes on working people, on people in low and middle incomes. I wonder if Rishi Sunak really knows the value of £20 a week. And I wonder if I stole a 20 quid note from his wallet every day, if he would even notice. They are so out of touch. That's why their policies are unable to address the problems facing our country, many of which have now been directly created by 13 years of Conservative government. And that's why I thought it was some brass neck last week for Rishi Sunak to present himself as a change candidate. I mean, who is he trying to kid? 13 years. And he thinks that they can be the change to solve the problems that they cause. I don't think so. And that's why it's even more important that the Labour Party is offering that change and that hope, not just the possibility, but the policies that get people thinking, yeah, okay, I can see a way out of this. I think there's a decent team here with the right ideas who've given me some hope and belief that if I go and cast my vote, things might just get better for people in this country once again.
But isn't there a danger that you're just indulging in sort of rather cheap identity politics here? I mean, Tony Blair did an awful lot for less well-off people in this country. He hardly came from the school of hard knocks. I mean, is this any different to the sort of identity politics that some Tories engage in, saying, unless you have my background, you can't do this? I mean, some people are empathetic, some people aren't. And to me, it doesn't seem to matter what your background is. Aren't you sort of overdoing this a little bit?
I think the problem with where we got to with the last Labour government was that, Tony Blair and John Prescott and the team declared victory too soon on a classless society. You're right. I mean, you know, we lifted more than 1 million children and pensioners out of poverty. You look at the transformational impact that Sure Start made on early years. You think about the children and young people whose child trust funds have matured and they've now got out of capital lump sum to invest on the early stages of their career or the early stages of their life or the next phase of their education. We did some incredible things, but classless society, we moved the country in that direction, but there is so much more still to do. In fact, we've moved backwards. So I'm happy with the fact that we have a leader who is talking about class inequality in our society. Because I think when you look at the populist backlash that we have seen in this country, in Europe, in North America, one of the big drivers of the populist backlash are people who have been overlooked and felt left behind, basically rebelling with their vote and exercising the power they have to send a message to elites to say, what we've got ain't good enough, and we are going to disrupt the consensus and the status quo until people start to focus and notice. Now, it's contingent upon us both to marginalise the populace but also provide real solutions to the pain and the economic inequality and injustice people feel, to have a serious plan. And that's what I think Rachel's outlined today with her speech, along with Jonathan Reynolds and the rest of the team in the Shadow Cabinet, in terms of the new jobs, the reindustrialisation, making sure that Britain is home to the industries that will shape this country's future and the global future.
All right. I mean, but you slightly dodged the question there, so I'm going to try again in a different way.
Not often I'm accused of doing that. I think I said no. I don't agree with you. They declared.
No, but what I'm saying, but you don't necessarily have to have had a working class background to understand the plight of those people who've rebelled, do you? I mean, isn't that just potentially quite poisonous, saying unless you're from my background, you don't understand these things? If anyone could understand these things.
No, I think divert, but I think it's the way I would kind of, you know, push back against that challenge is that, you know, having diversity of perspective around not just the cabinet table, but any room or authority or body where power is being exercised, it is important that you have diversity of perspective and experience. And not just to tick a box and to make yourself feel good about yourself and just to rattle off some statistics. But, you know, you talk to, and this is where I think business leaders in this country and are ahead of the politics in some ways. You know, people perform better when they can be themselves. You have a much better chance of serving your customers, or in the case of government, citizens, if your decision-making body looks more like and has lived the lives of the people over which you've been entrusted responsibility and given power to exercise on their behalf. And that's what I think where the challenge comes with class politics and class representation. There have been lots of other strides in diversity. I mean, the House of Commons is definitely a more representative place than it once was. We've in the parliamentary party, we've got a majority of women. Of course, in the Conservative Party, I look at the cabinet and I think they, you know, and I listen. Actually, one thing I will say for Rishi Sunak and his speech last week, and one thing I say about the appointment of Rishi Sunak as the Conservative Party Prime Minister, political differences aside, I'm really proud of the fact that this country has a Prime Minister of Indian heritage and a practicing Hindu. I'm really proud, not just because what it says about our country, but what it says to kids growing up in my constituency who look like Rishi or share his faith, or perhaps come from their roots lie in other countries around the world, or they have a different faith which isn't the established church in our country, but see people in positions of power and think, I could do that. Maybe there's a route in for me. So, you know, I don't think I'm sort of being too partisan and too hard, but I'm afraid, you know, when it comes to class inequality and the extent to which working class people have been seriously hurt by this government, you know, I do feel that sense of grievance, and I'm afraid that is where I do carry with me into the House of Commons an experience and a background that I haven't forgotten. However much I might live a middle class life now and have a, you know, slightly less Cockney accent than when I was growing up after going to university, you know, I have not forgotten my roots, and that is why I feel aggrieved, not least because in my Friday afternoon constituency advice surgery, I meet kids from backgrounds like mine growing up in the same poverty who are even more disadvantaged than I was. They don't have a council flat. They're living in temporary bed and breakfast accommodation. They don't have the great state education I have, not just because of the crumbling roofs and the pressures on school budgets, but because they're moved from pillar to post in housing, which means being moved from school to school. Their parents don't have the same extended family network that my mum had when she was bringing me up, because, you know, in the case of now a number of families in my constituency, they've not just been moved across London, they've been moved across London and up to Wolverhampton. What chance have these kids got growing up in circumstances like that? So that's why I'm angry. And that's why I think it is highly pertinent and highly relevant that we've got, you know, a government and a cabinet that is so dangerously out of touch with what life is like for most people in this country, let alone people who are really living life at the sharp end at the moment.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? There are some people who say you're essentially fighting a battle of the past, because for many people, the big division in our society now, which, if you like, puts you on the other side of the fence, is not between working class and other classes. It is between people who've got a university education and people who haven't. I mean, if you look at voting patterns in this country, it is education that is the dividing line. And actually, you're on the other side of that dividing line, aren't you? You went to Cambridge, and that is the real problem that Western societies are grappling with now, is that big distinction between those who went to university and those didn't. You can see it in electoral patterns in the United States. You can see it in the Brexit vote and subsequent elections here.
Yeah, but the class divide is directly linked to the education divide. Don't think for a minute that because there are exceptional stories like mine, that it's all hunky-dory, and that the difference is just between kids who were clever and kids who weren't clever. It's about those of us who had the right support and the right opportunities and the right security in place. And, you know, in my case, I don't feel like, you know, I feel like I sort of beat the odds, but I don't doubt the fact that the odds were stacked in my favour. And I don't doubt, you know, based on what I see in my own constituency right in front of me, that the odds are still stacked in kids' favour. And in fact, from kids from background like mine, I can see that things are more difficult now for those kids than they were 30 years ago. So I don't think this is remotely about the past. I think it is about the country we live in now. And, you know, on the university side of things, though, just to pick up one of the challenges, you know, Rishi Sunak laid out last week in terms of too many people going to university. Which one of his kids is he not sending to university? Because it's always, and this is my problem with this, we had this with a 50% target, and I know there's the other 50%. I'm absolutely right. We've got to get, you know, the right system in place in terms of high quality apprenticeships, technical and vocational education and training. We've got to get all of that right. Totally on board with that. Actually, Ewan Blair makes this case powerfully in terms of the work that he does on apprenticeships and the criticism he levels of the 50% target. I think there is a legitimate criticism in there. But what I have always been, you know, very frustrated about is two things on the 50% thing. One is, you know, when people say too many kids are going to university, they normally mean other people's children, not their own. And the second is, you know, and I would accept that there are some universities who are, you know, laud themselves as widening participation success stories. And then you look at their retention, you look at their graduate destination data. And I think, you know, getting bums on seats and taking their fees, but not giving them the education and the foundation for a great career, that's not genuine widening participation. Don't kid yourselves or kid those students. Raise your game and improve your graduate destination data.
Okay, I want to ask you about your grandma, who features in your book quite a lot. Now, one specific question. You say your grandma wouldn't allow copies of The Sun into her house. You've written for The Sun. What would you say to her about that?
Sorry, Nan. no, there's a serious point. I mean, no, my Nan... I think she picketed the Whopping when Rupert, literally she would live the stone's throw from where News International moved to, just off the highway in Whopping. And she was outside with a loud hailer and rabble-rousing, causing trouble, as she often was, on a whole range of issues. You know, I've no doubt if my Nan was still alive, we'd be having this argument around the kitchen table and, you know, a significant number of decibels in her case, although I'm hardly a shrinking violet. I think that this pretty tired debate actually about whether or not Labour MPs should, you know, do interviews with or write in right-wing newspapers is... a very redundant one. We've got to talk to and for the whole country, not just the people who agree with us. We've got to reach those people and make our case on our terms, because I tell you, if they're picking up a copy of The Sun or The Mail and we're not in it, they'll just read the Tories' version of us. So we've got to engage. I've got no qualms with people who make their choice not to buy The Sun. And in this city in particular, given its history, and given The Sun's history, I have total respect for the boycott. I would not criticise or condemn people who've made that choice one bit. But I hope people can understand why it is so important when we struggle enough as it is to capture the attention of voters, when we are up against an immediate, you know, a media that is, you know, not normally disposed to Labour, why it's so important that we make the case to reach the voters, to earn their trust and the permission to make the change we want to see. And I'd rather deliver radical policies than strike a radical pose.
I'm sorry, I've got one more grandparent question. I mean, you write and talk about your family, so these are things that occur to me. You say your grandma went out and campaigned against the Docklands development. Would Rachel Reeves call her a blocker?
That's a good question. I think that what Rachel and Angela are talking about is not just about getting new buildings up and glitzy new development. And don't get me wrong, you know, as an EastEnder, actually, I sort of understand what the JDAC campaign was all about and why they were worried about the gentrification of the East End and working class people getting left behind. We see some signs of it. But I think what we're talking about is building infrastructure that benefits ordinary people, the homes that people need, the transport infrastructure that people need, the energy infrastructure that we need, not just to achieve net zero, but crucially to bring people's bills down, to create jobs in areas that have suffered massive deindustrialization, and to give Britain its energy security back against a very challenging global backdrop. So I don't think my nan would be campaigning against any of that. I think actually she'd be saying, when's the leaflet round coming?
All right. I want to ask you a couple of questions about the NHS and a couple about Labour before we throw it open. On the NHS, would you give consultants 12% and junior doctors 35%?
I'm not daft enough to engage in shadow negotiations, as I said on the platform with the BMA this morning. What I do think, though, is that there's one thing Rishi Sunak ought to do today, his number one priority ought to be, it's getting around the table with doctors and resolving an end to NHS strikes. He hasn't got a cat in hell's chance of cutting waiting lists or delivering patients the timely access to care that they deserve without ending the strikes. And I think he knows that. And I think he's just concluded he hasn't got the policies to cut the waiting list and honour his pledge, so he'd rather scapegoat doctors and find solutions. This is part of my problem with the Conservative Party. They see challenges in this country as challenges to be exploited rather than solved. They want to divide people rather than bring people together and heal and move forward as a society. You compare the nonsense, he said last week, attacking doctors, with what we've said this week, practical, credible, deliverable, 2 million more appointments a year. What's not to like about that?
And is it really credible to think of consultants who earn over £100,000 wherever they live in the country as being underpaid?
I think consultants, no, I certainly am. Where's this idea I don't answer questions come from? It's my part of my problem is I answer questions. I think consultants will understand when I say that I'm not losing sleep at night worrying about whether they can pay their bills. And I think consultants are emotionally intelligent enough to know that the people that they work with on shifts in hospitals or wherever else they work in the NHS are having a much harder time than they are. And then you look beyond the boundaries of the NHS to wider society and people at the sharp end of the cost of living crisis. Actually, to be honest and to be fair to the consultants for a minute, when I talk to them and say, what motivated you to go on strike? I can't think of a single conversation I've had with one of them where they mention pay as their number one thing or even their top three things. It's about the conditions they're working in. It's about the moral injury they felt. And I think they've seen the rest of the NHS workforce going out on strike, it feels like, worst strikes in the history of the NHS. And they've chosen to take a stand to demand better working conditions for themselves, but also for their patients. And the big risk, I think, for the NHS isn't just that staff walk out for another day of strike action, it's they walk out of the NHS altogether. We've got a retention crisis in the NHS, as well as a recruitment challenge that's led to an under-doctored NHS. And that's why, for me, my priority would be lower paid staff in the NHS, and I think consultants would understand me having that priority and understand that's a reasonable priority to have. But I think there is a deal to be done with the NHS workforce around the wider range of conditions that they're working in. And that's why I don't understand why the Prime Minister isn't getting the negotiations up and running, because I genuinely think there is a deal there to be done.
I mean, one of the reasons they're striking is conditions and hours. So I wonder how, in that context, paying them for overtime is going to help, when actually it's the number of hours that's part of the problem, particularly when they want to do overtime, they could do it in the private sector and get paid even more. I don't quite understand the logic of that proposal.
I think I'd say two things. One is we haven't come up with this policy out of nowhere. We've looked at hospitals. Now, unfortunately, there aren't enough of them doing this, but we're looking at the hospitals, like Guy's and Tommy's, where they have adopted this approach. And let me tell you that their agency spend has plummeted. The NHS is spending £3 billion a year on agency staff. Why? Because we don't have the flexible working. We're not treating staff with enough care and respect. And so if you don't offer flexible working to your staff, they seek that flexibility themselves through agencies. And we all end up paying more. Worse for them, more expensive for the taxpayer. And what we've come up with is a plan that would put money directly into the pockets of NHS staff. Doesn't rely on every member of staff to do it by any stretch. Doesn't compel any member of staff to do it. And as to why would they choose the NHS rather than just going up the road and just doing even more hours in private, don't underestimate the extent to which the staff who work in the NHS really believe in the NHS and its mission and its public service ethos. And don't underestimate how much they care for their patients. What they want is to be treated with respect. And if we're asking them to do some extra hours at evenings or weekends, to be paid fairly. And that is what a Labour government will do if we're given the chance.
Okay, we started this conversation with you talking about voters losing faith in politicians and in politics. Doesn't that mean that you just need to be straight with us? I mean, at the end of the day, like the Health Foundation have estimated that just to keep pace with demand, the health service budget is going to have to go up by 3% annually. You've got hospitals with a lack of capital investment. Isn't the sad fact of the matter that whoever wins the next election, our taxes have to go up or our public services are going to get worse?
Well, I'll say a couple of things. Firstly, where Rachel Reeves has sought to raise money for specific policies that would make a real difference, like with the NHS, she's chosen fair means. So that's why you end up with non-DOMs, why you end up with loopholes being closed for private equity fund managers, why you've got the windfall tax on the huge excess profits of oil and gas to help people with the cost of living. I think that's a very clear statement of intent about the fairness principles that motivate Rachel. But here's another truth about the NHS, which patients see and staff see. There's a hell of a lot of waste too. And that waste occurs when people try and get a GP appointment but can't because we've under-doctored general practice, they end up walking through the door of A&E. So instead of costing 40 quid to see that patient and get the problem solved, it's cost 360 quid to attend accident emergency departments. Because we tell people who are mentally unwell that they're not sick enough to access mental health services, come back when you are worse, we end up spending more on the care of that person who ends up achieving worse outcomes than if we got there sooner. That's why our approach of dedicated support in every primary and secondary school and community mental health hubs is not only better for patients, but better value for the taxpayer. And what I'm not prepared to do, and what Rachel is certainly not prepared to do, is to pour ever-increasing amounts of taxpayer money into a system that isn't wired effectively and doesn't spend the money as wisely as it really ought to. And that's why, unapologetically, for the last couple of years as Shadow Health Secretary, I have elevated reform above investment as my argument, partly as an acknowledgement of the reality that the public finances are in a mess, thanks to the Conservative Party, but also because I felt, well, I don't have to persuade people in a way that the NHS could do with more money. That is the default assumption of people. I have had to persuade people that the NHS needs reform. And when I started out as Shadow Health Secretary, I had loads of people giving me grief. Oh, whatever you do, don't use the reform word, which to me was like red rag to a bull, so I did it more. But now people are saying, yeah, you know, we get it needs to change. Let's talk about what that change looks like. Brilliant. That's exactly the conversation we need to have. Because when I think about the existential nature of the crisis in the NHS, it's not just the immediate crisis of waiting lists, terrible though that is. There is an existential challenge beyond the politics of the Conservative Party, which is when you look at our growing ageing society and you map across that rising chronic disease, unless we change the way the NHS works and is wired, and unless we shift from late-stage diagnosis and treatment to early intervention, early diagnosis, early treatment, and crucially prevention, then that chronic disease and old age threatens to overwhelm the entire model of the NHS and the principles upon which we founded the NHS as a public service free at the point of use, there for us when we need it. And that's what I'm determined to protect and to save and conserve. In order to do that, we need to change the system to defend the principles upon which it was founded.
Okay, thanks. One final one from me. A lot of the opinion polling at the moment puts Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer neck and neck when it comes to who has the best vision for the country. Are you worried that whilst the public have certainly gone off the Conservatives, they haven't found a reason to love Labour yet?
We're not remotely complacent. And when you hear us say, you know, no room for complacency, when you see a shudder when someone says, and here is the next Secretary of State for Health and Social Care. It's not just, by the way, there's very likely to be at least one, if not two or three, before the next general election. It's because, you know, we know that trust is earned. And people elect governments, not just because they've rejected the other lot, but because they've been given a reason to vote for change. And so what gives me confidence is that Labour has once again got the hearing. I think we grabbed the microphone from the Conservatives. And I think now, as people see and hear the specific policies, they will begin to imagine the change that that would make to their lives in a very practical, meaningful sense. And ultimately, it's only through doing that that Labour will win a general election. If we just sit back, put our feet up and say, oh, well, they hate the Tories, they'll vote Labour, we'll wake up to a very nasty shock of an unprecedented fifth term of Conservative government. But luckily for us, and even more fortunately for the country, we've got a leader and a leadership team and a party culture that is not remotely complacent. And even though we have seen opinion polls translated into real votes in Selby, in Rutherglen, we're not complacent.
All right, we've got a few minutes now to take questions. Not many, I'm afraid, because I've gone for too long. But, oh, blimey. There's a lady at the back with a microphone who I'm going to allow to give the microphone to the nearest hand that she spots. So I'm.
Oh, you coward. You've passed the buck to that poor woman at the back with a microphone.
It's called delegation.
Right, okay, thank you. Well, thank you for answering the questions in such an honest way, Wes. Very impressive, I must say. Interestingly, my question is, and I'm looking at it, how would a Labour government build an NHS fit for the future? The reason I'm answering it is, you know, when you listen to so many replies, it's difficult to, you know, go away with a summary in your head. So what would be your top three bullet points answering that question?
Three big shifts. The shift from the focus on acute hospitals to better primary care, community services, mental health, social care. Second big shift from an analogue NHS to a more digitally driven NHS, where we're using cutting edge life sciences and technology, which we have in abundance in this country, and making sure that patients get access to it to revolutionise the way we deliver care. And the third big shift is from sickness to prevention, which is why things like banning junk food ads targeted at kids, or our supervised toothbrushing program to stop kids being admitted to hospital with tooth decay, which, by the way, is the number one reason for children's admission to hospital aged 6 to 10. Can you believe it? Tooth decay in the 21st century. So, it's those sorts of things that will be the big reform. And the retail offer at the election will be the first steps that give the public that tangible, meaningful, crunchy way to take what are actually quite big principles into very practical change, where people think, yeah, I can see that making a real difference to my life soon.
All right, you shame me now. The lady here.
Yeah. Hiya. So we know that we need research in the NHS. The care we and our loved ones receive in the NHS today is thanks to the research of yesterday. Delighted to see this feature in the health mission and in the national policy, and in the MPF document. So we know it's good for patients, it increases retention, decreases burnout. We'd be really interested to hear, Wes, about how you think we can change that culture of the NHS to really value research in the NHS, for example, with protected time for clinicians.
And that's an interesting idea, which we'll take away and think about. Just to say, like, I think we've got a total disconnection between the ambition of clinicians to take part in research, bearing in mind, you know, the people who are doctors, some of the finest minds in the country, don't they like telling me, but they are genuinely some of the finest minds in the country. And they want to be there for their patients, but they also are constantly thinking about, well, how can we deliver better care? What are the new treatments, the new technologies that can make a real difference? And we don't give them enough time. And I'm afraid, you know, when it comes to clinical trials, you know, we're going backwards on this. Participation in commercial clinical trials has fallen off a cliff, which means less innovation taking place in our country and also less income for the National Health Service. So a big part of my agenda is getting that research culture back and making it much easier for life sciences and medtech to work with the NHS as a partner through a single front door where they can test and trial new treatments and new technologies and with the diversity of population we have in this country, so that the UK is at the front of the queue for adoption and rollout, but also so that they can then know that instead of having to, because this is how it works right at the moment, if you work with one NHS trust and you can prove your concept and get approval, you have to go and try and get through every other. I mean, we're not using the benefits of a single payer system in the National Health Service. And so just making these, you know, it's not the sort of thing I'm afraid I can put on a leaflet because it's pretty technocratic. But my goodness, it'd make a real difference to patients if we get it right.
Everyone knows that doctors are failed political scientists. That lady, lady there.
I don't think that's true, sadly.
Hello, Sarah Wootton, Dignity in Dying. I've read your book and I was delighted to see you're a Star Trek fan. Is the end of life the final frontier for patient choice?
That's a great question. It's very close to my heart at the moment, having lost my grandmother on Friday evening after a pretty awful final 6 months of coming off life extending treatment, which has given us 10 years with her that we never imagined we would have, to watching someone reach an inevitable and unnecessarily, you know, unnecessarily drawn out end. Now, actually, I don't know, because it's, you know, not the sort of conversation you would necessarily have in this circumstance, whether she would have chosen to exercise a right to die if it was available. But thinking about my other grandmother and watching her slowly die of lung cancer, I just, you know, I still have burned into my memory the image of, you know, my maternal grandmother dying on a hospice bed of lung cancer. And the, you know, the difference between my two grandmothers is actually my, you know, my grandmother who died on Friday actually was made really comfortable with what I would call really good, kind, caring, loving support from her local NHS trust, from Marie Curie nurses coming to attend overnight, and with drugs that meant actually, although she was dying slowly, she was dying comfortably and pretty painlessly. Contrast to my grandmother I lost when I was much younger, who died in excruciating agony and pain. I voted for assisted dying when it was last put before Parliament. I've got to say I've never agonised over a choice quite so much as that one, and I'm still not entirely sure I made the right choice. Because I think in principle, I don't mind the idea of someone exercising that choice. In practice, I worry about all the safeguards, the risk of coercion, the risk of pressure, either in deliberate pressure or unintended pressure. I think there are lots of moral, ethical and practical issues to work through. But I do think that it's so important we have this conversation, not just in the context of dignity and dying, but in terms of palliative care and how we die well and how we give people a great send-off. So I think as a country, it's always a taboo and it's very difficult, and particularly for me today, very raw to talk about. But I think being able to talk about death is, and giving someone a good death is such an important part of the public policy debate we should be having.
We've got time for one more. I suppose we should take the gentleman there just to get one from that side.
Yes, I can relate to what Mr. Schreding was saying. I come from a working class background and I have a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, but I've never lost my roots and still remain connected to people. Actually, I moved to the USA about 30 years ago and was able to skyrocket up pretty quickly there. But what I noticed at the 2016 election was a failure on the part of the Democrats to really get away from just bashing Republicans and not get their message out on issues of social and economic justice. And I'm hearing something similar going on here, where there is, you know, the conservatives are bad, but there's an over, it seems like there's an overemphasis on it. What's the message that Labour is trying to get out? Where is it? That's what I really need to know, so that the people can get a good handle and say, yes, we're going to vote. And we want to get away from the 50-50.
One of the things I'm proud of with my conference speech, which I'm delivering on Wednesday morning, is I spend... don't sore subject. I'm in so much trouble with Keir's office at the moment. I've got about 1,000 words to cut out. One of the things I'm most proud of is that even pre-edits and pre-cutting the number of words, I spend very little time in my speech talking about the Conservative Party. I think people can see what's wrong with the NHS. They want to know what we're going to do to put things right with the NHS. And in the end, it will be our plan to cut waiting lists by delivering 2 million more appointments a year, to provide the dentist crisis response we need with 700,000 more dentistry appointments a year, our plan to double the number of diagnostic scanners in the NHS so that people get seen faster, our plan to provide mental health support in every primary and secondary school and a community mental health hub in every community. Our plan to give people the family doctor back, not just by training thousands more GPs, but cutting through the red tape and the measures by which they are judged by, to get rid of the stuff that's of low value and to financially incentivize the continuity of care that patients want and doctors want to provide. Those are the things that will persuade people that change is possible and Labour is capable of delivering it. And I could give you countless more examples from across the board, from Bridget Phillipson's breakfast clubs that would mean that children start the day with hungry minds, not hungry bellies. Ed Miliband's plan to create more jobs, cut bills, and give Britain its energy security back. Those are the practical policies that will give people hope that change is possible and a belief that Labour is capable of delivering it. Of course, we've got to do our bit of holding the Tories to account, but it goes back to the point I made at the outset. You know, we're not going to win the next general election by saying what's wrong with the Tories. We will be able to win the next general election if we persuade people the country can get its future back with Labour. And that's what this conference, Keir's speech tomorrow, Rachel's speech today, and the Shadow Cabinet platform is all going to be about.
No pressure, Keir. I'm really sorry we've run out of time, but Wes, I just want to say thanks ever so much for taking the time.
No, it's been great, and we've had a really interesting range of questions, so thank you very much.
Cheers.